helping the charity. Other people were informed that they would receive a small candle in return for their donation. The candle created an exchange fiction, allowing people to say, "I didn't donate to help. I was buying a candle." As expected, people were more likely to donate when they would get a candle in return compared to when no candle was offered. They also donated much more money under these conditions. Ironically, getting a trinket in return allows us to cover our generosity with a non-altruistic account and thus frees us to act more altruistically. Alexis de Tocqueville, the French scholar who wrote the first great book about the United States, Democracy in America, in 1835, noted his surprise when it came to Americans' thoughts about their own good deeds. "The Americans are fond of explaining almost all the actions of their lives by the principle of self-interest. In this respect, I think they frequently fail to do themselves justice. In the United States, as well as elsewhere, people are sometimes seen to give way to those disinterested, that is, not self-interested, and spontaneous impulses that are natural to man. But the Americans seldom admit that they yield to emotions of this kind. The fact is, we are full of both selfish and unselfish motives. And this is no accident. Mammalian brains are wired to care for others. And among primates, this caring extends to at least some non-kin, even when there is no material return on the investment. Because of the way our brains are wired, eating a delicious piece of cake is enjoyable whether we are hungry or not. Similarly, helping others feels good whether we expect something in return or not. Just imagine what things would look like if we were taught about this in school and we understood that altruistic helping is just as natural as being selfish. The strange stigma associated with altruistic behavior would be lifted, perhaps engendering far more pro-social behavior.
You listen to WRUV FM Burlington's not DJ, not Ted. He doesn't exist anymore. It's just James. Sorry. That's my old DJ name, is not Ted. This show is about sociology, social capital, maybe a little mix in of philosophy and highly science-based. That's the goal of the show. And the name of the show is Radio Lyceum. My name is James. You listen to WRUV-FM Burlington. It is 9:03, which means a little bit past the time we need to cover the news. And the news today is coming from The Cynic. It's right down the hallway. I'm pointing to it right now. You can see my finger going down the hallway, The Cynic, UVM's paper. So the headline we're reading today is Men's Soccer Put Vermont on the Map. This is old, from January. Well, oldish. So, Vermont's soccer puts Vermont on the map. Over the winter break, the UVM men's soccer team brought home the NCAA Division I National Championship. The first UVM or any American East team has competed for or won. Unseeded, the Catamounts fought up an uphill battle to nearly every preceding round of the tournament, defeating number 7 Hofstra in overtime, number 2 Pitt, and in the last minute of regulation, and number 3 Denver in penalties to reach the final. With 32nd half goals and 15 in the 82nd minute or later this season, the Catamounts earned reputation for delivering victories with odds stacked against them. UVM took the pitch and carried North Carolina against number 13 Marshall University on December 16th, 2024, opponent that appeared in 2 national championships, winning 1 of the last 5 years. So, go UVM Catamount soccer team. That was pretty awesome. I didn't get to see it. I just heard about it. So I'm a former UVM student, so that's pretty exciting. It is Friday, the 31st, and the weather for today is going to be snow showers, low 7 degrees. We must be getting close to that. Ooh, it's going to get chilly. Tomorrow, it's going to be a high of 12 degrees, mostly sunny, and it's going to be a low 4 degrees below in the Fahrenheit, because we're using American units here. It's in America. And on Sunday, it's going to be high 22, a low of 19 degrees and cloudy. And going on to, hey, welcome to Vermont, weather, a high of 38 degrees, a low of 27 degrees, and PM showers. So snow, wicked cold, and then rain on Monday. So yeah, that's the way it goes here. So I'm going to play a little bit of we're going to play the public service announcement, a little bit of music, and then we'll get right back into Social Wire Brains or Wired to Connect. And that's, I think, pretty much what's going to carry me out to the end. I'm going to play a little music after the end of the show. You could also call me here at 802-656-4399. That's the on-air booth number. You could also email me if you want to make any comments or suggestions, or in particular, I'm looking for nonprofits that would like to come on and talk about potentially what you do in the community. So, without further ado, let's play the public service announcement. Keep on listening to your better alternative, WRUV FM Burlington. You're listening to Radio Lyceum.
When we think of distracted driving, we typically think of cell phones, and for good reason. Cell phone use while driving leads to 1.6 million accidents every year, according to the National Safety Council. But there is another form of distracted driving that doesn't get discussed very often, and is probably a more common driving habit than cell phone use. That form of distracted driving is rubbernecking.
Rubberneck driving is the act of turning your attention away from the road for more than a brief second. Whether you're trying to take in the Vermont foliage, identifying someone vaguely familiar walking down the sidewalk, or attempting to read the closing hours of your favorite coffee shop, you're putting yourself and others at risk of serious injury. According to Flagger Force, taking your eyes off the road for more than 2 seconds doubles your risk of getting into a car accident, and 1 in 4 accidents are caused by an inattentive driver. Sometimes accidents are even caused by drivers rubbernecking to catch a glimpse of the aftermath of another car accident. You freaks. You may be engaging in this poor driving habit more often than you realize, and nobody ever anticipates the car in front of them to brake abruptly, or a pedestrian to suddenly dart across the street like an idiot. A lot can happen in a few short seconds,
PSA.
And we need to be ready for anything when operating these heavy machines.
This message has been brought to you by your attentive driving DJs here and performers at WRUV FM Burlington.
My eyes are always solidly fixed to the road, even when I'm not driving. Because that's how I roll. In my whip.
Oh,
trumpets call, the trumpets call. Oh, children, oh, children, bring love to the world,
love to the world,
love
to the world, love to the world.
Heaven help us.
Me in the mirror. Descartes' belief about our dual nature, mind and body, was a profound error about the way nature works. But it was an accurate assessment of how our brains represent the world. Hundreds of years before the neural data was discovered, Descartes recognized that there is a deep division in these two components of how we see ourself, body and mind. Does this mean we have two selves? If so, which self do we recognize when we see our reflection? Once fMRI became popular decades later, scientists examined self-recognition in the scanner to determine its neural bases. Across more than a dozen studies, a clear pattern has emerged. When people see and recognize a picture of themselves, in contrast to pictures of friends, celebrities, or strangers, regions in the right prefrontal and parietal cortex on the lateral surface of the brain are more active. In addition, the parietal region that responds to seeing one's own face also responds to keeping track of one's own body movements. Neural dualists. For 40 years, we have taken mere self-recognition as a decisive sign of self-awareness in others. But the truth is more complicated. In Cartesian terms, this test focuses on the recognition of our body as our body. In Descartes' meditation, it was the irreducibility of our minds that led to his famous maxim, "Cogito ergo sum," I think, therefore I am. When we urge people to know themselves, are we talking about the same kind of knowing that lets us know it's us in the mirror? Mere self-recognition is a kind of self-awareness, but is it really representative of the deep kind of self-knowledge that we seek? Bill Kelly, Todd Heatherton, and Neil McRae, prominent social neuroscientists from Dartmouth College, ran a simple but elegant experiment that answered this question conclusively. In an fMRI study, participants were shown adjectives such as polite and talkative. For some of the trials, participants had to judge whether the adjective described George W. Bush, who was the U.S. president at the time. On other trials, participants had to judge whether the adjectives described themselves. The critical analysis examined whether there were any regions of the brain that were more active when people judged the applicability of an adjective to themselves as opposed to George Bush. There were only two regions of the brain whose activity followed this pattern. Just as in the mirror self-recognition studies, there was activity in the prefrontal cortex and parietal cortex. But unlike the mirror self-recognition studies, these activations were present in the medial prefrontal cortex, MPFC, and the precuneus, on the midline of the brain where the two hemispheres meet, rather than on the lateral surface of the brain near the skull. In other words, recognizing yourself in the mirror and thinking about yourself conceptually rely on very different neural circuits. Seeing yourself and knowing yourself are two different things. There are at least two major implications of this distinction between self-seeing and self-knowing. First, this distinction clarifies what the mere self-recognition test tells us about the animals that can pass it. chimps, dolphins, and elephants all have some sense of their corporeal identity, that the body they see in the mirror is their body. However, the fMRI data suggests that passing this test does not imply that these animals engage in self-reflection the same way that we do, reflecting on whether we possess a particular personality trait or wondering what will become of us in 10 years. It does not imply that these animals reflect on the wisdom of their past decisions. And it certainly does not imply that these animals come to have a conceptual sense of self through introspective contemplation. Second, the neural separation of representing our own bodies and representing our own minds explains why we can't get away from Descartes' mind-body dualism. All signs point toward mind-body dualism being a bad explanation of what we are, and yet most of us operate like card-carrying dualists. We can't help it, because it is literally wired into our operating system to see the world in terms of minds and bodies that are separated from one another. We have one system for thinking about our own minds and another one for recognizing our own bodies. And these systems are separated in the brain. It is not that minds and bodies are separate realms in reality, but the ways we register them are separated in our brains, and there isn't much we can do to bridge this neural chasm. Just as colors and numbers are experienced as radically different because they depend on disassociated systems in the brain, our mind and body are forever cleaved from one another. Trojan Man. The Trojan horse was not at all what it seemed. Instead of being the spoils of war, it was a cleverly disguised deception that allowed the Greeks entry into Troy and led to its being overtaken by the Greeks. In the same vein, I would argue that we can describe our sense of self as a Trojan horse self. In the West, we like to think of the self as that which makes us special, providing us with a unique destiny to reach our personal goals and achieve self-fulfillment. We imagine the self, our sense of who we are, to be a hermetically sealed treasure chest, an impenetrable fortress that only we have access to. If this were really the whole story, such a discussion of the self wouldn't have a place in a book on the social brain. But as it turns out, the self may be evolution's sneakiest ploy to ensure the success of group living. I believe the self is, at least in part, a cleverly disguised deception that allows the social world in and allows us to be overtaken by the social world without our even noticing. 19th century philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche gave the most cynical view of this Trojan horse self, writing, "Whatever they may think and say about their egoism, the great majority nonetheless do nothing for their ego their whole life long. What they do is done for the phantom of their ego, which has formed itself in the heads of those around them and has been communicated to them." Nietzsche believed that our sense of self was not something inherently internal to us, a true core to our being, that we gained greater access to over the course of our lives. Instead, he argued that our sense of self is typically something constructed primarily by the people in our lives, and that the self is actually a secret agent working for them more than for us. If one believes that the purpose of the self is to help each of us maximize personal rewards and achievement by better knowing who we are, then it would be tragic to discover that our self actually does something very different from what we think it does. Our responses to cultural trends give us some insight into how this process works. When I see a new look in clothes, my first reaction is often, "That looks ridiculous." Yet a few months later, I find that the trend looks and feels right to me. For a dramatic example of this, consider baby colors. Blue for boys and pink for girls just feels right. It may not be PC, but it's right. I can feel it in my gut. Just imagine if some store tried to switch things up and sell pink for boys and blue for girls. That would never catch on, right? Actually, it already did. 100 years ago, the color scheme for babies was the opposite of what it is now. Consider this comment from a trade journal published in 1918. The generally accepted rule is pink for the boys and blue for the girls. Somehow, between 1918 and now, our visceral reactions have done a full reversal. Did each person reach this conclusion privately? Or was there some process at work to make sure our way of seeing things stayed in line with what we perceive to be the beliefs of those around us? Just like most of our beliefs, this visceral response to baby colors is something we pick up from the outside without even noticing it. Each of us has a variety of impulses, desires that if acted on at the wrong time, in the wrong place, and with the wrong people, could bring civil society to its knees. I would argue that the self exists primarily as a conduit to let the social groups we are immersed in, that is, our family, our school, our country, supplement our natural impulses with socially derived impulses. The social world imparts a collection of beliefs about ourselves, about morality, about what constitutes a worthwhile life. Because of how the self functions, we often cling to these beliefs as though they are unique ideas we came up with for ourselves, the products of our private inner voice. It is not enough for us to recognize what the group believes and values. We have to adopt the beliefs and values as our own if they are to guide our behavior. In other words, just like the Trojan horse, much of what makes up our sense of self was snuck in from the outside, under the cover of darkness. We might believe the self exists to help strengthen our resolve in the face of outside forces, but this theory of who we are overlooks the ways our brain uses those outside forces to construct and update the self. In your eyes. Imagine you are sitting in a room with 20 people, and each of you is handed a card from a standard deck of playing cards. You are not allowed to look at the card. Instead, you hold it on your forehead for all others to see. Everyone in the group is then told to try to pair up with the person with the highest card that will pair with you. In the beginning, you can see everyone else's value, but have no idea of your own. Within moments, you will have a pretty good idea, though. The woman with the Ace of Hearts will have a crowd of admirers, hoping to be chosen by her, while the man with the two of spades will quickly realize why no one is returning his gaze. George Herbert Mead and Charles Cooley, influential psychologists in the early 1900s, suggested that learning about ourselves in the real world is not so different from this little card game. In many cases, it is hard to look inside and really know who we are, and thus we tend to look to others, both intentionally and unintentionally, to find out. Mead and Cooley discussed a process that later became known as reflected appraisal generation. At its simplest, a reflected appraisal is what I think you think of me. We are bombarded with feedback from others about ourselves, sometimes in words, but more often in the form of their nonverbal behavior and tone of voice. Mead and Cooley argued that we use this information to find out who we are. Rather than looking inward, we often look to others to learn about ourselves. If psychologists want to study the self while it is still under construction, when a person is actively generating these reflected appraisals to flesh out their conceptual sense of self, we ought to be looking at the adolescents who devote a lot of time and energy to this. When Jennifer Pfeiffer was a graduate student in my lab, she convinced me to do just that. We asked young adolescents, that is, 13-year-olds, and adults, to report on both their direct appraisals of themselves, for example, "I think I am very smart," and their reflected appraisals, for example, "My friends think I am very smart." There are a few things we should naturally expect to see in this study. First, direct appraisals should activate the MPFC, given that Bill Kelly and others have shown this link in dozens of studies. Indeed, this was the case for both adolescents and adults. Though adolescents showed greater activity than adults, consistent with adolescence being an intense period of self-focus. Second, reflected appraisals should activate the mentalizing system, as these involve figuring out what somebody else believes. This, too, was observed in both adolescents and adults. The results got more exciting as we moved into uncharted territory. Before this study, no one had ever examined how a 13-year-old's brain makes sense of itself. Our adolescents produced strong activity throughout the mentalizing system while making direct appraisals of themselves. The adults did not. Recall that the mentalizing system is typically associated with thinking about the mental states of others. These results suggested that even when we asked adolescents what they thought of themselves, they might have spontaneously brought to mind reflected appraisals, what they believed others believed about them. Rather than answering by directing their thoughts inward, adolescents may have unwittingly been focused on the minds of others when answering about themselves. The other novel result from this study reinforces this idea of self-knowledge constructed from outside sources. The adolescents in the study activated the MPFC both when making direct appraisals and when making reflected appraisals. This is important because on the surface, direct and reflected appraisals are very different psychological processes. A reflected appraisal is my assessment of what you believe. A standard mentalizing task that might not be related to my internal experience of myself. In contrast, a direct appraisal feels like it taps into a personal place of self-truth that only I have access to. Yet here we saw the MPFC involved in both. Perhaps in coordination with the mentalizing system, the MPFC is taking our assessments of what others believe about us as a proxy for what we should believe about ourselves. If this is true, then the medial prefrontal cortex is not the royal road to personal truth, but rather a reflection of various sources by which we learn about ourselves, some personal and introspective, and some generated from what we believe those around us think about us. This suggests that the MPFC may be involved in a social construction of the self. But is the MPFC actually involved in others influencing us and changing our beliefs? The second thing this study did was put a nail in the coffin of the idea that our self is what makes us distinct from others. From both the hypnosis and the sunscreen study, we have seen that the region of the brain that is so strongly linked to our conceptual sense of self is also the superhighway by which others influence our beliefs and behaviors. In the neural focus group study, rather than representing what makes us unique and different from others, the MPFC is actually serving as a proxy for how countless others will respond, hardly a marker of our uniqueness.
So just to cut in, just to cut in and talk about that segment a little bit. So I think what a lot of technical terms he's kind of throwing in for the certain regions of the brain that affect our image of ourself. But I think the general gist of it is ourself is a creation from the world, how other people perceive who we are, how other people perceive us, or how we think other people perceive us, which is Daniel Dennett's, one of his theories is of how consciousness is formed is basically that self-reflection of the self-reflection of the self-reflection of the self-reflection. Like, you know what I'm thinking because I know what you're thinking because I know what I'm thinking. So, but basically kind of ties in with, like, how other people's ideas and how they're formed isn't, like, based upon something that's immutable, something that they're born with. It's the people that they meet, the culture that they grow up in. It ties in with the idea, if I were you, you'd be me. Or if I, like, everyone's experience basically forms about who they become and the ideas that they form and how important social groups are in forming your ideas. So if you really want to change someone's idea, become part of their social group. Don't shout at them. Don't be mean to them. Because it really kind of separates you from their social group. Their ideas are formed from their social group. So I think it's a very interesting idea. Like, so many moments in this book, just reading through, I'm like, oh my God, this is mind-blowing. Anyway, we'll get back to it. We got another half an hour. I think it pretty much is going to be pretty much covering this book with a little bit of commentary mixed in with some of my feelings and maybe some of the things I'm like, some of the science kind of leans this way. Not that I'm an expert, but I have read a lot about it. So, number here is 656-4399. You have any questions or comments?
Not so selfish. If the MPFC is in fact a conduit for us to assimilate the values and beliefs of those around us, then the self may truly be a mechanism of and for the social world. The existence of the MPFC, more than any other mechanism in the social brain, ensures that a common set of values is largely shared by those in a long-standing community. The MPFC-mediated self may be the mechanism by which cultural norms and values are likely to flourish, lodging notions in our heads that we are committed to before we realize it, so that they are part of the common background of our identities and beliefs. Although the adolescent years might be a time when we are particularly self-absorbed, most of us eventually embrace an identity that centers on our relationships to friends and loved ones, as well as on the various groups to which we are connected, for example, religious, political, or athletic groups. Once we stop trying to define ourselves exclusively in terms of our uniqueness and accept a more balanced social identity, we often feel that we are finally who we were meant to be. As philosopher Alain de Botton wrote, "Living for others is such a relief from the impossible task of trying to satisfy oneself." Albert Einstein conveyed the same sentiments decades earlier. "Only a life lived for others is a life worthwhile." The modern world has created an extended period of adolescence and self-discovery, and thus, We think of this search for our unique identity as the most natural thing in the world. But I'm not so sure the self evolved primarily so that the Marilyn Mansons and Lady Gagas of the world could make a living out of being as different as possible from everyone else. Prior to the modern era, humans spent a few years being cared for as children and then moved into the workforce, often with responsibility for others, by the teenage years. Most had no time for soul-searching. Life was about being cared for or taking care of others from beginning to end. We have selfish impulses, and we have socially created beliefs and values that are also internalized as part of the self. There may be a battle between them, but by the time the battle is happening, it usually isn't us against them. It's us against us. Two parts of our own identity duking it out.
Are you listening to WRUV FM Burlington? This is Radio Lyceum with James, talking about how the self is formed. Was what just covered in the book Social Wire Brains or Wired to Connect. Just talking about the self. These other he made the case for how our self identity and who we are is formed by on the social groups around us, but there's definitely some genetic components to that, or even how language basically is formed, how language forms us, and how language is something that's actually in our own genetics. I think Noam Chomsky talked about this or researched that. Found the commonality, and believe it's Noam Chomsky, I'm pulling this out of my brain, found a genetic component where we're actually pre-wired to understand language, which also affects who we are and how we interact with the world around us. So, we're moving on. Just throwing out the email, you can contact me at radiolyceum@protonmail.com. If you have any questions, comments, or if you have any nonprofit organizations that you would like to promote, and particular ones that are looking for volunteers or have some kind of volunteer or social aspect. So keep on listening.
Is understanding our social brain merely an intellectual exercise, satisfying an existential urge to know what it means to be us? While that's an itch I'm always happy to have scratched, I think understanding the nature of our sociality is far more significant than that. Everything we do in life and all the organizations that we are a part of are affected by our understanding of who we are. Think about how amazing the brain is, and then consider that a huge portion of that amazing brain helps to make us more social. Yet for a large part of our day, whether we are at work or at school, this extraordinary social machinery in our heads is viewed as a distraction, something that can only get us into trouble and take us away from focusing effectively on the real task at hand. Chapters 10, 11, and 12 reveal how wrong this view is. Almost everything in life can get better when we get more social. The big question, a question that has been asked for as long as we have been asking questions, is what makes for a happy and healthy life? If we have been getting this wrong, we should all want to know so we can start getting it more right. In 1989, more than 200,000 college freshmen were asked about their life goals, and one goal stood out from the rest: to be well off financially. Perhaps these students had been reading Ayn Rand's novel Atlas Shrugged, in which one of the characters declares that money is the root of all good. Or perhaps they were just being sensible. If Bentham is right about pains and pleasures, having piles of money is a great way to avoid physical discomforts and to maximize access to life's material pleasures. Want to travel to exotic places and eat the world's finest cuisines? Want to go farther and orbit Earth from space? You can do all of these things, but only if you've got the bank account to get you there. There's no question that making more money is valued worldwide and that it provides access to countless resources. But does it make us happy? Economists have been obsessed with this question for several decades, in part because the income of individuals and nations was long taken as an objective indicator of their well-being, for it was believed that true well-being could not be directly measured. This assumption, in some ways, may have led money to be seen by society as an end in itself, rather than as a means to an end. Despite the presumption that true well-being cannot be directly measured, happiness, life satisfaction, and subjective well-being are actually measured quite easily. All you have to do is ask people questions like, "All things considered, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole these days?" And people will tell you. If you ask the same people today and a year from now, you will pretty much get the same answer from folks both times. People have stable, reliable responses to this kind of question. There are many ways to tackle the relationship between money and well-being, and economists seem to have tried them all. This surprising conclusion of nearly every approach is that money has much less to do with happiness than we think it does. Let's begin with the one and only analysis that ever shows strong links between money and well-being. If we look at a large number of countries, and for each nation get an average measure of well-being and get the nation's average income level, these two factors will be correlated quite highly. Countries with higher average income have citizens who report higher average well-being. But this kind of analysis may not tell us very much, because rich countries differ from poor countries in countless other ways. Rich countries allow for more individual freedom, have better schools and healthcare, have less corrupt judicial systems. Gross domestic product may just be a proxy for one or more of these other variables that might affect happiness more directly. Let's consider some of the other tests. Researchers have also looked at the link between money and well-being within particular countries. For instance, happiness researcher Ed Diener looked at surveys of thousands of U.S. adults who reported their subjective well-being and their income. There was a statistically significant relationship between how much a person earned and how happy they were, but it was extremely modest. Individuals' income explained only about 2% of the differences in happiness across the sample, and most of this relationship has to do with being below or above the poverty line. If you are below the poverty line, every additional $1,000 you earn dramatically alters your well-being. But once the basic needs are met, increasing income only adds the tiniest bit to well-being. Some have suggested that the proper way to isolate the relationship between income and well-being is to look for changes in income over time. For instance, one study examined changing U.S. income levels between 1946 and 1990 and compared these to changing self-reports of well-being. These results are striking. Income, after controlling for inflation, more than doubled during this time, and yet well-being did not increase at all. This effect, called the Easterlin paradox for the economist who first discovered it, has been shown for many countries, but for none more dramatically than Japan. Between 1958 and 1987, real income increased 500%, and material comforts multiplied similarly. For example, car ownership grew from 1% to 60%. Nevertheless, Japanese reported equal levels of well-being across these three decades. I don't know about you, but I find this all very disconcerting. I work hard for my money, and I work hard to make more of it. I do this because I know in my gut that if I can make more, my family and I will be happier. This brings us to the last stop on the money train to happiness. Some economists have tracked individuals across a decade or so to see if changes in their personal income level are associated with concomitant changes in well-being. They aren't. Some people...
Hey, this is James. I just wanted to cut in a little bit and talk about... income, wealth, and happiness. So there, most studies that he's citing is there's a large amount of evidence that basically shows that once you get past a certain level of wealth, that happiness doesn't really rise up. But there is one, I think there was one economist that did a study or a meta study, and I believed he found more of effect above that certain level that affect happiness. So it's not settled science, but I would say it's solid science about once you have a certain, once your needs are met, like adding additional wealth really doesn't add more happiness. But I just want to throw it out there because, you know, science is always kind of in flux, especially economics, which recently had a lot of social sciences and psychology kind of tied in to bring into more solid science. But I just wanted to make that point. Let's get back to social wire brains are wired to connect.
We're making substantially more money at the end of 10 years, and some were making substantially less. But well-being was unrelated to these changes. My gut says making more money will make me happier, but my gut is wrong. Explaining the paradox. I shouldn't be alone in my frustration at this point. The vast majority of people indicate that making more money is one of their primary life goals. We don't do this for the heck of it. We do it because we believe it will give us a better life in the end. Yet study after study reaches the same conclusion. It won't. We have been barking up the wrong tree. How could we, as a society, have gotten this so wrong for so long? What are we missing to end up so misguided in our theory about what will make us happy? After the lack of a relationship between money and happiness came to light, economists and psychologists each offered sensible explanations of the missing relationship between money and happiness. Psychologists pointed out that humans have the tendency to adapt to new circumstances, whether they are good or bad. This is called hedonic adaptation, and in many situations, it helps protect us from staying depressed forever over negative events. Unfortunately, the same mental machinery keeps us from staying elated after positive events. The most famous example of this is the case of the major lottery winners who were contacted some time after winning. They reported being no happier than individuals from the same communities who had not won. Economists generated a second explanation, focusing on the context in which one's income is considered. They suggested that the problem is that we focus less on our absolute income and purchasing power, and more on how much we are making relative to those around us. This relative income argument suggests that earning $50,000 a year in a neighborhood where most people earn $30,000 a year could make us happier than earning $100,000 a year and having neighbors who earn $200,000 a year. Missing social. Things are even worse than I've portrayed them, at least in the United States. Not only is increasing income not associated with increased well-being over the past several decades, but well-being has actually decreased over this time period. Sensitivity to relative income definitely accounts for part of this reduction in happiness, but it's not the whole picture. Something else is going on that can't be explained by these kinds of factors. In the book Bowling Alone, Robert Putnam first put his finger on what was missing in all of these analyses. Social. Putnam and those who have followed him have put together a number of variations on the same two-step theme. First, social factors substantially contribute to subjective well-being and life satisfaction. Second, in modern nations like the United States, these social factors are in decline. Let's take these in order. Economists use terms that sound like economic indicators, such as social capital and relational goods, to talk about a variety of social factors. These include being married, having friends, the size of one's social network, whether people join social organizations, such as bowling leagues, and trust in various societal institutions. Pretty much any way economists examine these social factors, they, unlike income, end up being significantly related to well-being. One study compared the impact of income and social connections on well-being and found that social factors had a more positive impact on well-being than income, once relative income effects were considered. Just how much are the social aspects of our lives worth in terms of our well-being? Multiple studies have managed to put a dollar value on them, determining how much more money you would need to make in order to achieve the same increases in well-being. In one study, volunteering was associated with greater well-being, and for people who volunteered at least once a week, the increase in their well-being was equivalent to the increase associated with moving from a $20,000 a year salary to a $75,000 a year salary. A second study found that across more than 100 countries, giving to charity is related to changes in well-being equivalent to the doubling of one's salary. Another study found having a friend whom you see on most days, compared to not having such a friend, had the same impact on well-being as making an extra $100,000 a year. Being married is also worth an extra $100,000, while being divorced is on par with having your salary slashed by $90,000. Just seeing your neighbor regularly is like making an extra $60,000. By far, the most valuable non-monetary asset researchers examined was physical health, with good health compared to not good health equivalent to about a $400,000 salary bonus. That might seem crazy, but if you were not in good health, how much money would you be willing to give up to be in good health again? The reason I mention health is that social factors are also huge determinants of physical health. Thus, social factors determine well-being directly, and, because they bolster health, provide an additional indirect route to well-being. The good news is that building more social into our lives is very cost-effective. Getting coffee with a friend, talking to a neighbor, or volunteering won't make your wallet light and could significantly improve your life. The bad news is that as a society, we're blowing it. Over the last half century, there has been a steady decline in nearly all things social apart from social media. People are significantly less likely to be married today than they were 50 years ago. We volunteer less, participate in fewer social groups, and entertain people in our homes less often than we used to. To me, the most troubling statistics focus on our friendships. In a survey given in 1985, people were asked to list their friends in response to the question, "Over the last 6 months, who are the people with whom you discussed matters important to you?" The most common number of friends listed was 3. 59% of respondents listed 3 or more friends fitting this description. The same survey was given again in 2004. This time, the most common number of friends listed was 0. And only 37% of respondents listed 3 or more friends. Back in 1985, only 10% indicated that they had 0 confidants. In 2004, this number skyrocketed to 25%. 1 out of every 4 of us is walking around with no one to share our lives with. Being social makes our lives better. Yet every indication is that we are getting less social, not more.
So I kind of covered this before on the program, but I didn't want to end on a negative note because that's kind of negative to being like, oh, everyone's less social. But the point of this show, I think, is generally like, hey, kind of pointing out how sociology is changing, and more positive note, be like, hey, here's how you can go on Connect. There is tons of organizations that are looking for volunteers out there. And Burlington, we were pretty lucky, or in other places, or Montpelier, other places, there's lots of social organizations out there that you can go and either volunteer or even just hang out, including this radio station on WRUV.org. We're going to have training coming up. They haven't announced when it's going to happen, but it's going to be pretty soon. It's open to the community and for students. It's on a positive note. This is how most of the friends that I know or have kept throughout the years are even tangentially associated with WRUV or directly associated with WRUV. So for me, it's been a lifesaver for my social groups. And it's about the perfect size. You're looking for groups, usually Dunbar numbers. You want your groups to be slightly above 100, less than 150. We'll talk about that little science fact later on. I have a little clip from Dunbar, but it's almost 10 o'clock. So join a social group. Go out there. There's tons of them out there. I'll be covering it. Don't panic